Hello and welcome to Think Business Futures. We're coming to you from 2SER in Sydney on the Gadigal lands of the Eora Nation. I'm Anthony Dockrell. Australia's relationship with China was back in the news recently with the Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi coming to Australia. The visit was another sign that the relationship was out of the freezer and moving forward. That doesn't mean that it was all smooth sailing. There was a great deal of angst in some circles with the news that former Prime Minister Paul Keating held a private meeting with Wang Yi. And if that wasn't enough, add the news that the United States may be about to ban TikTok, indicating that the US may be serious about decoupling from China. Where does this leave Australia, and can the Albanese government traverse an independent path through these competing interests? To discuss this and more, we're lucky to have Professor James Lawrenson, who is the director of the Australian-China Relations Institute. The Australian-China Institute is an independent, non-partisan research institute established in 2004 by the University of Technology, Sydney. Professor James Lawrenson, welcome to Think Business Futures.
Great to be back.
Now, you started your latest article in the conversation about the Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi's visit to Australia, but you said that the relationship between the two countries is fragile. What do you exactly mean by fragile?
Yeah, well, I was quoting other commentators there. There's a prominent view in Australia that because Canberra and Beijing both assess their national interests very differently, that there's a sense that at any moment those differences could rupture and, put Canberra back in Beijing's doghouse, just like it was under the Morrison government. But my own view is that things are a bit different now, and they're a bit more the positive relationship trajectory we've been on since May 2022. That was when Labor came back to power. I think it's a bit more resilient than a lot of people give it credit for.
Do you feel though, and you mentioned that we were in the doghouse, do you feel that we could go back to that position very quickly, or do you think maybe we've turned a corner?
Very quickly, no. But of course, if there were. I could certainly imagine significant developments that might cause the relationship to rupture again. But the sorts of developments that I've seen unfold over the last 6 months, including some not insignificant ones, right? So, for example, just last month, we had a Chinese court decision where you had an Australian given a death sentence, a suspended death sentence. But clearly, that is not an insignificant event. Mm. But you had Penny Wong and Anthony Albanese himself make very plain their disgust over that sentence, but it didn't then spiral out of control to affect other parts of the relationship. So just a few days after that sentence, for example, you had Australia's Trade Minister, Don Farrell, saying, look, we currently do $300 billion worth of two-way trade with China. There's no reason why that can't be $400 billion. So you've got this management of nuance and complexity at the moment that are navigating the positives and negatives of the relationship.
Now, look, China is Australia's largest trading partner by a large margin, and China needs us to supply key commodities so it can continue to grow its economy. This should be a pretty stable relationship, even if it's not a close one. Do you think we can continue to negotiate ourselves to the calmer waters that both parties are looking for?
Yeah, I'm pretty confident we can, because as you say, the trade only happens because both sides want it to happen, right? You can't force someone to buy your stuff. And so China's buying our iron ore, our wheat and our wool because they want it. And in many cases, they don't just want it, they need it, all right? When it comes to iron ore, when it comes to lithium, when it comes to LNG. And we've actually seen a good case study of this unfold over the last few years. I mean, in 2020, when the bilateral political relationship, time of the Morrison government, plumbed the lowest depth since diplomatic ties were established in 1972. If you looked at the overall trade numbers, 21, 22, and 23, they kept actually increasing. Now, I'm not trying to minimize the disputes in individual sectors. Wine, for example, the wine sector suffered. It was hit hard. But at an aggregate level, Australia-China trade has been incredibly resilient, and I expect that to continue.
So I guess it's in the situation when it comes to the trade between the two countries, there's the story of the actual numbers, and then there is, I guess, the tone and the rhetoric coming from both parties. So there is a disconnect there as well, isn't there?
Yeah, and the other thing I think to note about the trade side of the relationship is, of course, Beijing doesn't trade with Canberra, right? What's happening there is Australian and Chinese businesses and households are getting on trading with each other. So I think the important point on the political side of the equation is Beijing and Canberra don't have to be lovey-dovey best mates, but if they keep things at least stable, then those businesses and households and individuals, they'll just get on with doing what they're doing. And for the most part, that's exactly what we've seen happen.
Now, when two foreign ministers get together, their messaging is as much for each other as it is for their own domestic political audiences. What were they saying to each other and what were you hearing?
Well, I was quite surprised because I had the good fortune of being part of a private lunch with the Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi last Wednesday. And it was striking to me how in Wang Yi's tone and in the substance of his language, it was actually very, very similar to that of our own Foreign Minister Penny Wong. Certainly, Wang Yi was not exuberant. He recognised there were differences between Australia and China, but he was certainly positive and he was very forward-looking. He had no interest, for example, in rehashing past disagreements, such as when Australia banned the Chinese technology company Huawei from participating in our 5G network or foreign interference laws, all this, or even AUKUS, right, that did not come up in the conversation. But he was keen to talk about or to emphasise that he thought there was, to use his words, untapped potential in the relationship that could be realised. And the way we'd realise that potential was by taking a mature and calm approach to managing the differences. Now, that is basically a carbon copy of what Penny Wong says when she says we need to manage our differences wisely.
So there seems to be a level of maturity, I guess, as far as the rhetoric coming from both parties.
I think that's correct. Look, probably two things. On the Australian side, I think you have seen the restoration of calm and professional diplomacy. So we've put down the diplomatic megaphone that, in my view, the Morrison government was a bit too eager to pull out. And then on the Chinese side, you've seen the wolf warriors, those aggressive Chinese diplomats, you've seen them put back in their cage. And Beijing also removing restrictions on areas of mutual benefit in the relationship, like trade. I mean, let's not forget, it was only a couple years ago when Beijing had restrictions, tariffs and import bans on around about a dozen Australian goods. That list is now down to 3, and from next week it'll be down to 2 because we all fully expect the Chinese tariffs on Australian wine to be removed by the end of this month.
Now, was there anything that from the Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi that he was saying that you think we should be taking note of? Was there anything hidden in there that he was, underlining?
I think the key point is the same one that Penny Wong stresses, the fact that both sides are very clear-eyed in their differences, right? Probably the biggest difference is that Canberra wants the United States to play a more prominent role in determining the regional order than does Beijing. So there's that recognition, but there's also an agreement that neither side wants to let those differences overwhelm the entire relationship and start crimping areas where both sides' interests are actually very well served, such as trade, for example. But not just trade. I mean, the people-to-people ties between Australia and China are enormous. We do a lot of very productive scientific collaboration together. So we don't want those political differences crimping areas where we're actually doing some pretty amazing cooperation at the moment.
Now, there was a lot made about former Prime Minister Paul Keating meeting privately with Wong Lee. Was this a storm in a teacup, or was there something fundamentally wrong about Keating having this meeting?
I don't think there was anything fundamentally wrong with having the meeting. So just to be clear, I have no problem with Australians criticising Paul Keating for accepting the meeting, right? We live in a liberal democracy. Mm. That's fine. But the main criticism I heard was that Paul Keating was serving as essentially an agent of influence for Beijing, that by accepting that meeting, Beijing would get a sympathetic and prominent local voice pushing its messages. But my sense, at least in my reading of the Australian media over the last week, is that if that was the intention of Beijing, it's actually backfired because I think there's been a lot of commentators, and you hear talk from within Penny Wong's office as well, that meeting wasn't particularly welcomed by the Australian government. So look, we're a liberal democracy. I don't think we should get too upset about events like that, particularly when the evidence is that those sorts of events don't actually give Beijing a lot of, you know, it doesn't really help Beijing spread the messages that it would like to spread.
It seemed a little bit confused to me that people thought this was sending the wrong message for Keating to hold this meeting. We've just been talking about the idea of building up a more robust relationship with China, and it is improving. But it also seems that we are still caught up in waves of paranoia. I mean, if a former Prime Minister of Australia met with, say, a senior member of Congress from America, I don't think we'd be reading too much into that at all.
No, we wouldn't, would we? And look, it depends on what we mean by we are caught up in paranoia. I certainly see what I regard as some paranoia in Australia's mainstream media and amongst some hawkish national security commentators. But let's not imagine that the Australian public at large is paranoid. You know, I think of a poll that was conducted by The Guardian just a couple of weeks ago, and it asked Australians how they saw the China relationship, and two-thirds of Australians said that they saw the China relationship as, quote, complex and needing to be managed well. Right? It's a complex and needing to be managed. Just one-fifth described China as, quote, a threat to be confronted. So actually, when I was talking with the Chinese foreign minister last Wednesday, one of the messages I delivered to him was that he should be assured that the Australian public is actually very capable of holding quite nuanced views on China, even if our mainstream media sometimes doesn't give that same impression.
And it's interesting that you talk about nuance, because that is what's missing in the media when it comes to China. And you see this across the board. China is portrayed as an opportunity, but mainly as a threat. And the threat seems to be the thing that the media focuses in on.
Yeah, so look, I can't pretend to be a media scholar, studies scholar. I'm an economist, but certainly I work with one of Australia's foremost media studies scholars, Professor Wan-Ning Sun, and she makes the point that a lot of things are combining here to give rise to what you're talking about. And look, one of them's geopolitics, but another one is just sheer commercial imperatives. The media industry is doing it tough and has been doing it tough for some time, and a good China scare story sells well. So it's kind of not surprising in that sense that oftentimes headlines gravitate towards those more extreme views.
Now, what do you think of the idea that in 2020 Australia was out of step with America when it came to China, because we were aggressively in conflict with China, and now as we improve our relationship with China, America is now trying to decouple? Just over a week ago, the American Congress passed a bill that, if passed into law, and it's not law yet, I think we should underline that, would have effectively banned TikTok. Are we currently moving the opposite direction to America?
Yeah, I think we're moving. Yeah, we're less extreme, no doubt. Just reflecting back on 2020, I think the distinguishing feature of that time was not so much that Australia was out of step with America, but we were out of step with every other middle power in our region. You know, you weren't getting the diplomatic megaphone coming out of Indonesia or Japan or Korea or the Philippines. I mean, these are other US allies, right, in the region. And none of them were behaving in the same way that we were. Nowadays, I do think we are more cautious around our policy decisions compared with Washington. And in a sense, that's not surprising. I mean, you know, America and China are engaged in great power competition. We're not. And particularly, while we do, and the Albanese government has doubled down on initiatives in the security realm like AUKUS, when it comes to the economics side of the equation, which is getting closer to what you were talking about, our Foreign Minister Penny Wong says that we're all in when it comes to regional economic integration, and that includes regional economic integration with China. I mean, Don Farrell, our Trade Minister, I remember last year, he described US controls on export controls restricting China's access to technology, he described them, quote, as draconian. You know, I can't imagine that language went down too well in Washington, but I think he's right.
Look, the Albanese government has expressed no plans to ban TikTok and actually seems to be charting an independent course there. But if America bans TikTok, knowing the AUKUS arrangements, knowing, you know, the security arrangements we have in place with America, Do you think it would be potentially difficult for Australia to say no, but we're not going to ban TikTok?
It'd be difficult, but certainly not impossible. And goodness me, if we're going to ban TikTok, you'd hope we're not banning it just because the United States did, right? You'd hope we'd do something because our own security intelligence agencies gave the government that advice. And as Anthony Albanese said a couple of weeks ago, they have not received any such advice from our own security agencies to head in that direction.
And look, just following this through, this thread through, I mean, if you accept the idea and the logic that TikTok is risky, and I think we both probably should put our cards on the table. I don't. But if we accept that TikTok is risky, then isn't BYD a risk? I mean, modern cars collect huge amounts of data. What about Xi'an? It's basically a social media company if you look at what it does with data and how it operates. Where does this end?
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. I think you've hit the nail on the head there. It's not going to stop at TikTok, is it? And we're already seeing hawkish members of parliament and commentators talking about the Chinese threat when it comes to electric vehicles. But, you know, I think the key thing for me to keep in mind is on TikTok, for example, what a lot of commentators are worried about is that Beijing might be able to influence narratives in Australia and in impact on the political discourse in Australia by controlling that platform. Well, you know, I'm just not so sure. Australia's liberal democracy is just so fragile and individual citizens are so uncritical that they lap up Beijing propaganda. In fact, if I look at Australian public opinion towards China over the last 5 years, it's cratered. So if Beijing was trying to influence us in recent times, they've been doing a horrible job. And I think we're not defenseless, right? I mean, we've got a vibrant free press in Australia. Mm. So if Beijing's manipulating some algorithms on TikTok, it's not like that's the only thing that's going to be happening. You'll have a bunch of journalists exposing any nefarious activities by Beijing as well.
And I was talking to Wanning Sun about this for another program, Fourth Estate, a media show here. And we were talking about TikTok, obviously, and it struck both of us that if Australia found itself in direct conflict with China over something like Taiwan, we could shut down TikTok very quickly. And I think in that situation, which we're talking about something that is completely unlikely, but in that situation, TikTok is not the issue.
100%. And it's not just TikTok. We've had this conversation when it comes to Darwin Port, for example, right? There were a lot of people when the Northern Territory government sold Darwin Port to the lease to operate Darwin Port to a Chinese company. There was a lot of panicked commentary in Australia about how that would open up Darwin to visit to the People's Liberation Army Navy and espionage operations. And our own defense minister at the time said that was utterly ridiculous. And if, as you say, if things got to the most extreme end of the line, such as Australia and China being in a war, then Australian legislation provides for our defence agencies to just go in and reclaim the asset. That's part of Australian law at the moment. And so therefore, our own Defence Department was actually quite comfortable. Our own security agencies were also asked to assess the risk, and they were also comfortable with the risk because they were confident we could manage them.
So in this place, in this, you know, where we are with the relationship between China and Australia, which I think is a really interesting one, and we've been talking about it here, that we've reached a more stable, more mature relationship, but there's still deep distrust, and the distrust seems to be driven largely by paranoia. Is there a way out of this? Is there a way of navigating our way through this, or is this the situation and we just need to manage it?
Certainly, it'll always be a challenging relationship, right? It'll never be as easy as Australia's relationship with the United States or the UK or New Zealand because of those many differences, not just politics, right? I mean, history, culture, language, and so on. But I think there's two things that really help. One is political leadership. And my own view is that I think we're getting pretty darn good political leadership out of Canberra at the moment. So they're very clear in putting Australia's positions and in implementing policies that they see as being in the national interest, but at the same time, they're not ripping out the megaphone at every opportunity to shout in Beijing's face or using the China relationship to prosecute domestic political fights. So I think that's useful. And the other thing probably would be that I think we should be encouraging the relationship to be as broad as possible so it's not just Canberra and Beijing talking to each other. I mean, I think having Australian and Chinese scientists working together in research, tourism in both directions, international students in both directions, vigorous company-to-company engagement. I really do think that all of that, non-state activity provides enormous ballast to the relationship. And I think both sides, Beijing and Canberra, absolutely recognise that point now. Whether a future Australian government or a future Chinese administration recognise it, that remains to be seen.
And look, talking about all that, it made me think of an incident that happened in November, which you talked about, where the Chinese battleship, it was alleged that they used their sonar to essentially harass an Australian naval vessel which had a diver in the sea at the time. The way both countries handled that, I thought, was really interesting. Do you want to talk more about that?
Yeah, I found that very interesting too. I found it very instructive. You know, that's exactly the sort of incident that I think 3 years ago would have been spiraled up to become a very significant incident that would start impacting on other areas of the relationship. But that's not what happened. So if you listen to what Penny Wong was saying and Anthony Albanese was saying, they weren't shying away from who they were laying blame on or the facts around the incident. And of course, China was presenting a very different position. But we moved on. It wasn't allowed to fester or to be magnified. And at the same time, you've had ministerial level visits occur on both sides. You've had productive trade between the two sides grow. You've had more and more Chinese students arrive in Australia. So that's exactly my point. That had potential for a new political rupture, but the politics was tense but controlled. And at the same time, the fact that that was, the politics was stable, then allowed other parts of the relationship to continue to expand. I think that's a very useful template for Australia-China going forward.
And if you think about what happened between China and America over the balloons and how that just spiraled out of control to a point where they were shooting down weather balloons.
Using $450,000 Sidewinder missiles, by the way, which just, punctuates the point. Yeah.
Look, you end your article in a positive place when it comes to the relationship between the two countries. So despite all the headwinds we've just been talking about, and those headwinds are fairly significant, you remain optimistic.
Fundamentally, yes, with the caveat that, of course, a more extreme event could always throw things out of control. For example, I mean, just to take one of the most extreme possibilities of all, if Beijing decided to invade Taiwan, right, or set up a rigid blockade around Taiwan, the Australian government would be forced, I think, to take some pretty strong countermeasures, and that could absolutely send the bilateral relationship into a darker place very fairly quickly. But I don't see that as being the benchmark outlook of the type of events that we can expect. I think the type of events we'd expect are the ones we've seen over the last 6 months, like that sonar incident last November. And I think the track record developing now is that both sides are actually pretty capable of managing events and disagreements of that level.
Now, it's clear the Albanese government has moved the relationship to a more mature place. I think we've explained that. Do you see this as providing a model that maybe Europe and America could be, I guess, using and being influenced by? Or do you think the dynamics are too different?
I do think there will be a lot of countries looking on with a good degree of admiration for what the Albanese government has achieved over the last 2 years. You know, it's funny, even the United States, I remember not so long ago, President Biden was also talking about wanting to stabilize the relationship with China. And I thought, that's interesting, isn't it? You've got a US president borrowing the language of the Australian foreign minister. But look, I think the domestic politics in the United States and just its status as a great power and its own sense of exceptionalism, I think, means that the US relationship with China will always run on a particular track. And I don't think Washington's going to be looking to Canberra too often for tips on how they might manage their own bilateral.
Well, look, on that note, I mean, we're building a more strong relationship with China. At the same time, America is decoupling from China. Another name for decoupling would be a Cold War. Add Trump into the mix. Do you think we may be entering a time where Australia needs to chart its own course more, think more exclusively about our own interests and basically say to ourselves, we are independent?
Yeah, look, and to be fair to our own government, in particular Penny Wong, when you listen to her language, that's the language, that's the direction that she's actually pointing to. You know, she says we continue to welcome China's economic rise, we continue to welcome economic engagement with it, and we continue to support deeper regional economic integration, including with China. So look, I think that message from Penny Wong actually goes down well, very well, in Southeast Asia. So it's not as if the path Australia is currently heading down, we're alone in that. In fact, I think it's the consensus view of this region that we don't want to get caught up in a new Cold War and see the world divided into two blocks. Look, on the security side of things, I think there is pretty strong evidence that we are further strengthening our ties with the United States through the AUKUS agreement, for example. But I just caution against getting too excited over that. I mean, Australia has long had this two-pronged approach. We've welcomed China's economic rise and deepening economic integration with it. But we've always recognised that there was a possibility that when China became rich and powerful, it might convert some of that wealth into military force. And so we needed to balance in the security realm. So there is one reading of AUKUS that just says what we're seeing is really just a continuation of the two-pronged approach Australia's pursued for decades, literally since the 1970s.
And just to end on that point, I mean, Australia is a middle power, but it's also a democracy. So I think a middle power that's a democracy in the Pacific, having close ties with America is completely logical.
Oh, it certainly is. And, you know, let's be clear. I mean, there's very few people imagining that Australia should walk away from the US alliance, right? Mm. What I do hear people saying is that we need to reflect critically on that alliance. And I mean that in an academically critical sense, so that we can arrive at positions that serve Australia's own national interests, that we don't just get, sucked up in the slipstream of a great power doing whatever a great power wants to do. Sometimes that won't be in Australia's interests.
Well, Professor James Lawrenson, thank you for coming on Think Business Futures. And you've I sense, unpacked a lot of the, you've deconstructed a lot of the paranoia that's going through this relationship and found the mature centre, which I thank you for.
My pleasure, and I think our foreign minister's done that as well.
And thanks for listening to the program. This edition was recorded at the studios of 2SER and is made possible by the assistance of UTS Business School. If you want to listen to this program again or share it with your friends, just go to 2SER.com or you can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Think Business Futures will be back next week. I'm Anthony Dockrell. Thanks for listening.